Oops. Very good. So, can you see over there? I want to move over to this side? I've got my own little. What about you? You can't see. Okay. But anyway, just to let everybody know that this is a translation of the Venerable Tavokas, the word of the Buddha. It's a compilation of suttas. It's built around the framework of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And doing this was because the translation, which was over 100 years ago, is well past its use by date. And so because of that, it was nice to be able to do a new translation. And also the way that we do the translation, if you haven't heard this before, is to make sure that you don't translate word for word. Because word for word translations are just to make very silly translations, such as it was raining heavily and you say it rained cats and dogs, and if you translate that into a foreign language they think it's really weird in Australia that cats and dogs come falling from the sky. And so that's what we call an idiom. And even Pali has idioms in which that there's words which are said, ways which words are used. And so I take my cue, my advice, from Professor A.K. Warder, who would state, and I thought it was a very good insight, that we never translate words, we translate sentences, phrases, which are the units of ideas. So we never think word, we think sentences. And indeed the words are defined, the meaning is defined by the context. So that gives much more clarity and also, what people say, punch to these translations. And some of these translations are, again, past their use by date, even by themselves, such as things like right further down, you would see the right motivation, the second effect of the Eightfold Path, instead of right thought. So we call it right motivation. Now we have right action, right livelihood. The sixth of the Eightfold Path is, I translated as right endeavor rather than right effort. Because effort, again, in my life as a monk, the effort usually tends to get you tired, it tends to get you tense, it seems to be the opposite of what we are trying to do. And instead, I try to look for some other possible translations, so far using the word endeavor. And so we have like a type of goal, but not which comes from effort, but as you'll see in a few moments, comes from stopping, letting go, restraining, abandoning, those types of so-called effort. Really, it is a non-effort. And of course, the big one later on, number eight, is right stillness instead of right concentration. So it's good to take these translations even further. I'm never going to state that this is going to be the fixed and final translation forever. Translations are always work in progress. So anyway, with that in mind, just to get back to what I said before about these translations, a new translation on the word of the Buddha. So I usually start with paying homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So what now is right endeavor? This is the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. What now is right endeavor? There are these are all quotes from the suttas. There are these four right endeavors: restraint, abandonment, development, and preservation. the four right endeavours. And what is the endeavour of restraint? Now straight away you can see that word restraint means not doing something but stopping doing something. A restraining, an abandoning, a letting go. You might call it the effort to let go, but really letting go is the opposite of trying to get somewhere, effort. So what is the endeavour of restraint? When you see an object, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilement. So you can see straight away, getting sucked in. That is the word we'll use in English. It's a modern word, but it's not the word you see that in the translation 100 years ago. What is endeavour restraint? When you see an object, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. See, since if you left the faculty of sight unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom when seeing. You guard the faculty of sight and you undertake the restraint of sight. So, if you're a monk and you see some unclad woman coming into the hall, and then you make sure you try and look at something which does not arouse lust in you. If you're a married woman and you see a hot guy coming in, you don't look at things which will again create lust or a desire. If you see something you don't like, you don't allow yourself, just because a person may have some marks or scars or not be physically perfect, you don't let yourself get sucked in with aversion. If you see someone who resembles Donald Trump coming in, you don't look at those features which remind you of Donald Trump and allows you to get aversion. So in other words, you control the faculty of sight so it doesn't sort of get you upset. And also, even if you see something you really, really like a new iPod or a tablet or dress or car or something, which you say, wow, I'd really like that, you actually just restrain the features of sight. So you don't allow yourself to get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. Having heard a sound, noticed a smell, sensed the taste, felt a bodily feeling, even having cognized something in the mind, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. Since if you left the mind faculty unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom with the mind. You guard the mind and you undertake the restraint of the mind. So this is what we do with the mindfulness, but we also use the restraint, so we don't make sure we do not get drawn in to features which make us get lost in what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or know. The endeavour to, at the end of every section here, I will give you the opportunity to ask a question if you need to, so you can always put your hand up. So the second endeavour, the endeavour to abandon. What is the endeavour to abandon? Here you do not maintain an arisen motivation of wanting. You abandon it, let it go, renounce it, bring it to cessation. You do not indulge an arisen motivation of aversion, an arisen motivation of harming. Whenever bad motivations arise, you abandon them, let them go, renounce them, bring them to cessation. This is called the endeavour to abandon. So restrain, you don't allow sort of states of mind which will cause you grief, struggle, unpleasantness, affliction. So you make sure they don't come in the first place. And if they have come in, you find ways to abandon those unpleasant states. And the most common and commonly known method of abandoning is this Vitakka Santana Sutta, the Majjhima 20. When you are mindful of some object, and the rise is in you, afflicting unwholesome motivations connect with desire, aversion, delusion, then. First way, substitution. you should give attention to some other object that generates wholesome mind states. Thus, unwholesome states are abandoned and subside. With their disappearance, your mind becomes internally steady, settled, unified, and still. So if you're really upset about something, a good way of substitution is the old simile of the two bad bricks in the wall. If you just watch the two bad bricks in the wall, then that gives you feelings of aversion, wanting to destroy, wanting to start all over again, feelings of not being competent or whatever. So instead of just looking at the two bad bricks, you look at just the 988 good bricks, which means that your mind does become internally steady, settled, unified and still. Or another object which you may go and look at, I'm just relating this to some of the stories which you've heard on Friday nights, is to go into the forest and look at crooked trees. And look at crooked trees and they become beautiful. So by changing the object from, say, your husband, your wife, or your scores in an exam, or other things which are happening in your life, and you think, well, life is terrible, you change to some other object, usually in nature, and you think, this is the nature of the world, and in fact, you don't have to be perfect. So by giving attention to some other object that generates wholesome mind states, the unwholesome states become abandoned and subside, and you become internally steady, settled, unified, and still. Or you should examine the danger in those unwholesome motives. So you may sort of think you want something, or you're trying to get rid of something, but what does that do to your mind? That is an example of Ajahn Chah's, it's not the sound disturb you, it's you who disturb the sound. Because if you have what you think is a not loud sound, and you start to worry about who did that, why did they do that, it may just be that somebody slammed the door, and the danger in that, and thinking about those unwholesome states, is long after the sound from the slamming door has subsided, you are still thinking about it. So the danger is that sound stops pretty quickly, but the echo in your head goes on forever and ever. So that's the danger in those unwholesome motives. You can't sort of go back in time and sort of stop that banging door, but what you can see is the thinking about it, dwelling upon it, is very, very dangerous. It takes you away from happiness. You should try to ignore those unwholesome motives and do not give attention to them. And that is, we will find a simile which I've developed of, if there is, say, a sound, or there is sort of when you're meditating, you want to think of, you haven't had dinner tonight yet, and somebody's going to take you out to your favorite restaurant tonight, and you start thinking about the dinner. When any distracting thought comes up, you can use a simile of the TV screen. I travel a lot in aircraft, and when you look at the safety demonstration which comes in front of the screen, there's something I noticed a long time ago. It doesn't matter how big or small that screen is, after a little while, your mind actually fits into the screen. You may be looking at that in that big piece of canvas there, and your mind just fits right into the canvas, so much so you can't see what's above, below, left or right of it until I point that out. When I look at the same teachings on the screen of this little tablet, again my mind fits into it, and I don't see, I can now see the bell to my right, see the clock to my left, but after a while you go right into it and you can't see the edges. Now, understanding that what is in the center of your field of attention remains, what's in the edges eventually falls away, just like zooming in on Google Earth. It's the same with, by putting attention, ignore the unwholesome motives, do not give attention to them, do not put them in the center of your screen of attention. So put something more wholesome in the center, you know, like you're watching your breath, and somebody makes a noise, or there's a sound of the siren, or somebody revving up a motorbike. For goodness sake, don't put that in the center. In other words, take the attention, the primary attention, away from that disturbing, distracting sound or thought, and put the center on, you know, the main object. So that's called like ignoring it, not giving it attention, not giving it primacy in the mind. It literally is background noise. but you don't pay attention to it. And after a small while, the background noise fades away. Or you should give attention to studying the causes of those motives. Why do you want something? Why have you got ill will? Why is that happening? And there's one reason which I've noticed, that people are afraid of stillness and peace. I've seen that years and years and years ago. Whenever we would go to a very quiet place, you know, just like Bodhinyana Monastery, and some visitors, as soon as they would go there, it was so quiet, they would raise their voices. They would shout louder than was necessary. And I couldn't figure that out psychologically until I realized that the silence threatened them. And they had to raise their voices to destroy something they weren't familiar with. You know, the peace and the quiet of an Australian forest. So, what are the causes? When you are in meditation and the thoughts disappear, why is it that thoughts come up again? I always considered that thoughts just came into my mind from nowhere. And they were stray thoughts. Until when my meditation got much stronger, my mindfulness more sharp, I realized, no. I went out to look for those thoughts. Something to disturb myself. And of course that was the same as when you're at home, you've got nothing to do. So you flick through the TV channels. You flick through the TV channels. You don't really want to watch something, you just want to distract yourself, because today's people do not know how to deal with resting, silence, doing nothing. Or you look in the refrigerator, you've had enough to eat, you want to get yourself something to eat. And the refrigerator, things are falling out of the refrigerator, but there's nothing to eat in the refrigerator. It's just distraction, wanting something to do. Because doing nothing challenges us. Literally challenges our very idea of who we are. So it's stilling the causes of those things. And of course the last thing is the causes of some of these unwholesome thoughts, anything to do, because again, that we are uncomfortable with silence. It's mostly fear. And it's exactly the same fear, the best example which you can relate to, sort of, is a prisoner who's been in jail for many, many years. And now he's or she's been released from jail. And they're very, very uncomfortable in freedom. They've got used to being enclosed, being told what to do, being imprisoned. And the idea of being free is a challenge to them. So many of the causes of unskillful acts and thoughts and the motives behind them often comes from the fear. So if look at what the fear is. Find the causes for these things. And then the unwholesome things, the irritating things can disappear. And the last is, the very last resort, is you should, for example, if you get so fed up with Ajahn Brahm's jokes, you think, oh, I'm going to get a chainsaw and cut off his head. If it's a very, very bad thought, a very bad motive, the last resort, clench your teeth with your tongue pressed against the roof of your mouth and beat down, constrain, and crush such afflicting, unwholesome motives. So use a little bit of force, but only if it's going to be the last resort. And anyway, with the disappearance of these unwholesome motives of greed, hatred or delusion, wanting, aversion, delusion, then your mind becomes internally steady, settled, unified and still. So this is how one can overcome unwholesome things. This is restraint, first of all, and then abandoning. The second one. Yes. It's just right next to you, John.
Ajahn, you said that we invite the thoughts in, but I don't think that's always the case. Sometimes thoughts come that we really wouldn't like them to be there.
Ah, is that the case? That's what I always thought. But why would they come in? You know, if you could, where you live, do people just come into your house? They've got to open the door for them, first of all. It's a weird thing, but it is the case that these thoughts only come in when you're a little bit bored, not content, and they come in, and basically, before you even see it, you go out there to grab a thought. Otherwise, this, why is it that we go off into future plans which we know will never happen? Or what you're going to do when you win the lottery, how you're going to spend it? It's not going to happen. But why do we actually do stuff like that? Or thinking in a past which we can never ever change, fantasizing, dreaming. Why do we do such things? You know that sometimes we look for good thoughts first of all, but when we've gone through our inventory of good thoughts, then any thought will do, anything to distract us. It's a weird thing, but people like being distracted. Why? Because it's a discomfort, a fear of being still. And where that comes from, the underlying reason, is because it challenges our very existence. We define ourselves by not who we are, but what we do. I'm a monk, I'm a meditator, I'm a doctor, I'm whatever else, I'm retired. It's what you do, your acts define you. And if you did absolutely nothing, your very sense of being will actually start to vanish away. To do, so to be, even as you know as a doctor or as a medic, if somebody is lying on the floor and you need to find out if they're alive or dead, you see if they do anything. If their heart is doing anything, you shout at them, see if there's any response. Shine a light in their eyes, see if that does anything. If they don't do anything, then we assume they're not there, they're dead, they're gone. So this is just an example of the very essential connection between doing something and existing. You look at a stone outside, or you look at a log, you might kick it. If it bites back, we know it wasn't a log, it was a snake. But if it just sits there, does nothing, if it does nothing, it doesn't exist, the sense of a being. So when you do nothing, when you're getting still, sometimes the mind is not happy with that. Old habits, you have to do something. Does that make sense here? Yeah.
Yes, it does, but I still refer back to myself, but there's some things that come in and you'd never ever let them in. But they still come.
They come in. Basically, you do let them in, otherwise they wouldn't come in at all. And they won't, sometimes the stupid things come in. And you see afterwards, it's because if you're really, really content, very, very peaceful, then there's no way they can come in. But it is the fact that you see that you're leaving openings up, hoping something will come in to distract you. It's not that these things come in by themselves, but we go looking for them, searching for them, pulling them anywhere, anything just to distract us. It's the same with dramas as well. Why do people always have dramas in their life, in their monasteries, in their homes? Because people actually love dramas. They don't get enough dramas in real life. They go on the TV and get a drama from TV somewhere. Something to worry about. Because to worry is another form of existing being. Worrying about the football match. What are you doing that for? Something to do. Anyway, yes, young lady?
I was just thinking about what a good point. It challenges your existence, because people say, well, you might as well be dead if you're going to just sit there doing nothing. You're not interested in anything. You might as well be dead. Or you're putting your head in the sand. What for?
Yeah.
So really, that answers it, doesn't it? You're challenging your existence.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So this is a tough one, but that's the core of all this. who you think you are. That's also why sometimes these people who have been there, done that, so wealthy, they can't just disappear. All prime ministers have to say something, get on the news, stir things up. They can't just disappear gracefully, because if they disappear gracefully, you know, their Tony Abbottship has disappeared, their whole identity is gone. That's why you just can't just go quietly. Impossible. Anyway, that's one of the second of the endeavours. So, okay, you're going somewhere. And next is the endeavour to develop. So, restrain things which haven't come up yet, abandon things which are already in the mind, and actually develop good qualities. Now, these aren't separate, because one of the best ways to develop, to overcome what they call like unwholesome qualities, is to develop good ones. One of the best ways to stop burglars coming into your house is have all your friends in your house. You have lots and lots of good people in your house, then burglars out. Good people are there, so they won't come in. So developing and maintaining good states is also fulfills the first two endeavours as well, restraining and abandoning. And so what is the endeavour to develop? They don't actually say much what the endeavour actually is, except you know, the sort of things you should develop. Develop mindfulness, exploring the Dhamma. This is the seven enlightenment factors. Instead of investigating the Dhamma or contemplating the Dhamma, I hope we've got the same translation here, because this is a newer one than that one. There may be a few little changes. Exploring the Dhamma instead of investigating the Dhamma, this is that old little simile. I usually use a bottle of water. I've done this many times here, I think even recently. What is this I'm holding up? And people say, bottle of water. What else do you see? You know, it's plastic. What else do you see? What else do you see? That is actually exploring, going into it. Until you've already used up all the words and the labels you've been taught before, so you can actually go beyond what you've been taught and really getting into it. It's exploration. Contemplating is always thinking about this name and that way. It's going beyond the thought process, beyond the naming, into something which is much deeper. You explore it. You allow the mind to go to places where it hasn't been before. Or like I said in England recently, remembering the time I used to watch Star Trek as a young man. You know, that was when Mr. Spock did have pointy ears. But apparently it still goes on these days, Star Trek. Different people. But anyway, they used to say, to boldly go where no man has been before. And I adapted that to boldly go where no monk has gone before. And this is what exploration is. You know, not going to old places you've looked at before, but going deeper, exploring the Dhamma. And the enlightenment factor of energy. Now, both those two, I think I mentioned before, they actually work, no, all those three, they all work together. When you are aware, really aware, it takes a lot of mindfulness to be able to see things you've never seen in this before. And you explore it, and it gives you energy. It's actually really interesting. And also, because of the stillness, your mental energy increases. So whenever you develop these things, they develop all together. Start with mindfulness, exploration, energy comes up, the more powerful your mindfulness is. Rapture, the pleasure. And this is an important thing which in Buddhism, as it was from the very beginning, we actually develop joy. We develop happiness. We don't try and get rid of it, as if like being happy is a big sin. You're not supposed to be happy when other people are suffering. You're supposed to suffer in this world. And of course that is just so, even against Buddhism, some people even say, if you're happy, be careful, you get attached to it. And oh my goodness, that's what you're supposed to do. So here you develop the rapture, the pity, the joy, the happiness. And the enlightenment factor of tranquility. You don't think that being still or being tranquil is you're dead. like you were saying, Barbara, it's not being dead, it's being actually more alive than you've ever been before. And of course stillness, that's the samadhi and equanimity. Everyone is based upon seclusion, physical and mental. In other words, to develop these seven enlightenment factors, we are basing this on being by oneself reasonably physically. If you can't do that sort of in your rooms, in monasteries or in retreat centres, you can at least build a bubble around yourself, which I often do because I travel around a lot with many, many people. This is my cave which I carry around with me. This imaginary bubble around you, and you're sitting inside, and people and noise and things are outside. When I want to disengage, that's what I've really developed over the years. Physical and mental seclusion, things fading away, past and future thoughts all fading away, and ceasing, maturing in the mind's release. Those are seven enlightenment factors. And if you want to know just Buddhism in brief or meditation in brief, it's developed these seven and it's to overcome their antithesis, their opposite, which is the five hindrances. That's basically what Buddhism's all about. Do you want to get the microphone?
Could you please define the factor of energy a little bit more?
Energy, oh yeah. And there's energy you get from a cup of coffee. There's energy which you get when you've got a goal you're trying to reach and you really strive and you go for it. But those are all energies which actually are borrowing energy. You pay for that afterwards when you go, you're really tired and lacking energy. The other energy which this is talking about here is the energy which does come from developing mindfulness and stillness. It is what happens when people meditate and just become still. It is the observation, the understanding that when you do become still, you don't do very much. You're sitting still, you're not thinking about past and the future, you're not fantasizing. You're not wasting energy. And just like the metabolism in your body is always creating energy, your mind creates energy all the time, but it's wasted very, very quickly by thinking, worrying, planning. But imagine you stopped all of that energy being wasted. You weren't thinking about anything. It's totally in this moment, silent, preserving that energy. It's like getting your weekly payments from the government or from your job. You don't pay a cent. The money accumulates and accumulates and accumulates. And that's what happens with the energy when you're still, when you're not wasting it, you're not spending energy. It accumulates and gets stronger and stronger. It feeds into mindfulness. And your mindfulness really starts energizing, waking up. And the sign of that energy which comes up, is that, you know, after a good meditation, it's like you can run 100 meters faster than Usain Bolt. Just everything you see is brilliant and beautiful. Your mindfulness is empowered. That's why, you know, even people like Eckhart Tolle know the power of now. What it was is the power of mindfulness and being in this moment, not wasting any energy. And as you really wake up, you're energized, you're happy. Wow! Energy and happiness go together.
Can I then ask, when it builds up and it becomes a lot stronger, what if it needs a release of some kind?
Oh, why release? If you've got millions and millions of dollars, just keep it there. You'll find some natural ways of using it later on. But if it's in the body, if it stays in the body, then yes, you maybe might need a release of it because it's uncomfortable there. But if it stays in the mind, it can be as powerful as you want. You just get incredible powerful mind states. So that energy I'm talking about, which comes from stillness, is, yeah, it can be a physical energy, but really it doesn't belong in the body, it belongs in the mind. And that's when people get what we call the kundalini stuff, which is powerful forces in the body, but it's not pleasant. Powerful, but it's much better to use that energy in the mind where it really is much more useful and where it belongs.
So you can use it perhaps to either A, heal yourself or heal.
But actually, it's much better. Much greater healings come when you're not aware of your body. You just go into the realm of the mind, deep meditations, and amazing things happen. It's just well known that if you have any fevers or sicknesses, and you go and sort of try and zap them with loving kindness or with energy while you're still aware of the body, it does have an effect. But nothing like when the body totally vanishes and disappears, and you're in that sixth sense, really powerful, mindful, enjoying yourself, totally unaware of the body. And when you come out afterwards, the body is just incredible. You know what it's like? I'm getting old now. Sometimes if I meditate for an hour or two, just the knees ache, the back aches, the stomach doesn't feel good. I'm getting old. But, actually not getting old, I am old. But, if you get into deep meditation, you sit there, you can sit there for hours. You come out afterwards, nothing's wrong. You really feel like, you just had a massage or a bath or something. You feel no aches or pains anywhere. Which at first didn't make sense to me. Why is it you sit for 3 or 4 hours, this is going to hurt when I come out. But then, nothing hurts at all. You feel just so relaxed. So that's one of the things with the stillness and with the body and the mind. If you let the body go and just go into the mind, the body, that's the best you can possibly do for your body. Therapeutically.
So then the energy of the mind, how would you discern?
Discern it? Oh, well, just you're really blissed out. You're happy. Just really great happiness. And one way, because the energy and the happiness often go together. That's why people actually take a cup of coffee in the morning or something, and they're not only energized, but they're pleasant to speak to. They're not so grumpy. And I say most of anger and grumpiness comes from the tiredness people have in life. They're exhausted. That's why, if you've got a partner, please don't talk to them when they come home late. Just give them a cup of tea or coffee, whatever it is. And then when that's gone through their system, if they're really sort of tired, give them intravenous. And then when they come out afterwards, then they're a human being again instead of sort of a monster. It's just tiredness, that's all. Exhaustion. But when you really sort of had a big, great meditation, then, nothing can make you upset at all. So that's a sign of energy.
And you can use it in not only for yourself, for other things.
Yeah, solving problems.
So with the mind, then you would say it would be, as an example, say a ball of energy, and you may like to focus that on something.
Yeah, it's a ball of energy, but not frantic energy.
Yeah.
In sort of coffee high, not like stupid energy, when people take drugs.
Mm.
Natural, beautiful, pure. Okay, John had one first. John was next before you, Eddie.
The enlightenment factors, do they get developed after someone has developed jhanas, or do they start before?
Okay, this is the same as the Eightfold Path. The seven enlightenment factors is what you actually develop with the Eightfold Path. It's just like a parallel way of describing its development. So, even for right view, you've got to know what is right view. You develop some mindfulness, you explore the Dhamma. Exploring the Dhamma, you get a huge amount of right view there. And the other factors of the Eightfold Path, to be actually mindful. The seventh factor, mindfulness is not just something which I'm going to be mindful now. You develop it and you find its causes and how it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. One of the problems with the mindfulness movement, their definition is not sort of according to Buddhism, because they don't even take any account of just the powerful mindfulness which you get after some deep meditation, which is really cool. And of course the stillness there is the jhanas, and equanimity is just what happens when you get real right view and jhanas, nothing bothers you anymore. So it is a parallel development. Yes, Eddie.
Ajahn Brahm, the way I interpret, you know, these seven factors of enlightenment,
yeah,
is the, you know, like say for me, okay, yeah, like you have the dharma, you come in contact, you're reading a book, okay, you know, you feel like a dharma book, you feel happy, you know, just like it's just like when you meet your partner, you know, there's that energy comes in, you know, good energy, become mindful, and all these rapture, tranquility, stillness, equanimity. These are all peaceful, happy states that arise.
Yeah, but they,
that's why I interpret this as.
Yeah.
And you know, because the Buddha breaks down in this thing, it happens all in us. You know, it's all this covers, you know, the third to the seventh one. It's the happiness and peace. When you're reading a book, come with the Dharma. You see what I mean?
I see, but
yeah,
it doesn't take account of that every one of these is based upon seclusion, physical and mental.
Quite definitely,
yeah. But it's even your eyes shut, you're not reading a book or anything, and things fading away, cessation, maturing and release. So the full meaning of that is when you are meditating. Nothing in front of you. That's where you get the really full sort of seven facts of enlightenment. Anyway, because that's why I put these ones, if you actually have it in the suttas, as is usually translated, they have this last phrase, every one of which is based upon seclusion, physical and mental, fading away, cessation, maturing and release. They have that after every one, just to make the point that even if it's exploring the Dharma, it's exploring the Dharma based on seclusion, fading away and cessation, maturing and release. So it is actually reading, if you like, the Book of the Heart, rather than, you know, books written by monks like Ajahn Brahm. I was always warned of that, writing a book. This was one thing which I heard from a Zen monk when I was a lay Buddhist. Never write a book, because anyone who writes a book has to get the next seven lifetimes as a donkey. And I've written so many books now, I think I've about, how many books now? Six or seven? I've got about 50 lifetimes as a donkey to get through. I was only joking, but it was a powerful saying. The books are there virtually to show a direction. Anyway, let's go on to the next endeavour. This is to develop something. Once you developed it, to maintain it. And what is the effort to maintain? Here you keep in mind there is a meditation object that generates stillness, such as recollecting the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, or a skeleton, or loving-kindness, or the breath, or a nimitta. This is called the endeavour to maintain. So this is where you have something good. Of course, not everybody is the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha. You know, you choose which ones really mean something for you. Because it's not just the Buddha statue, it's just what it signifies for you. The Dharma, you know, what you understand as a Dharma, whatever creates stillness. The Sangha, or even like a skeleton, which is quite weird. Why is a skeleton developing stillness? But there's many monks, and not just monks, other people do this as well, which is really quite strange. There must have been monks in a previous life or nuns in a previous life. But sometimes when they're meditating, they can visualize a skeleton, or most usually a skull. And people think, that's really weird, you Buddhist. What are you visualizing a skull for? What actually happens? And it happens to so many people that the skull comes up in the meditation. It's just so easy to focus on. And it becomes just, real skulls are not pure white. They're just a bit off color. But they come really beautiful white, whiter than white, and it becomes like a nimitta. It's something which they must have been developing in previous times, and you know, it's just a natural remembrance for them, and the skull becomes into a nimitta, and it becomes a beautiful thing to do. The breath, or loving kindness, or the breath is the most common of the meditation objects, and often said because it is something which you knew from the time you were in your mother's womb, or when you are on her chest breastfeeding. It's a rhythm which you can remember as calming, secure, safe from the various earliest times. And as such, you know, it has a sort of a remembrance which maybe even you can't recall consciously, but from deep in your memory bank of safety and security, a very nice rhythm to be able to observe. And also it's what happens when other things disappear. So the breath is a very common thing to maintain in the mind, or a nimitta, which is the beautiful lights which come up in the mind. And of course, to maintain those, the endeavour to maintain those, how do you have something like the breath and keep it in mind? And if you try to focus on the breath and hold it, it's always, I told that simile even yesterday afternoon, just holding a glass. You can never maintain that because you get tired. You put it down and it actually stays there. It's very easy to keep things still. Like growing a tree. You don't make the tree grow. Your job is to push aside or make sure that there's nothing which damages or destroys that tree. So really what we're doing here, the effort to endeavor to maintain, is letting go of all the obstacles, dangers, and stuff which will destroy the natural growth of your meditation object. It's not making it develop, it's avoiding everything else. For example, developing the present moment. It's not focusing hard on the present moment, I've got to be in the present moment. It's actually avoiding the past and avoiding the future. When those other things are let go of, are warded off, so the present moment is protected from the past and the future, then of course the present moment will develop. That is the endeavour to maintain. Now, restraining, abandoning, developing and maintaining, these four endeavours were taught by the Buddha. By these means, a diligent meditator in his very life can attain destruction and suffering. I put that down there because you see by that, I said, oh, that's all we need. Just the six facts of the Eightfold Path. Restrain, abandon, develop and maintain, these four endeavours were taught by the Buddha. By these means, and a diligent meditator in his very life can attain the destruction and suffering. So, I say this because in the next one they say, just by mindfulness you can destroy suffering. Every time I give the precepts, when I offer the precepts, we usually chant Imani Panchasikapa Dani Silena Sukatinyanti Silena Boga Sampada Silena Nibutinyanti, that this sila leads to Nibbana, Nibbuta, things stopping. Tasama Silang Visodaye. So even the sila, it said, leads to enlightenment. But to do the sila, the precepts properly, you have to have all the other factors of the Eightfold Path. Even this one over here means all the other factors have to come in. So it's as if every one of the Eightfold Path needs the other ones to be purified to be able to do these things. So you can't just say one factor is enough, you have to do all the old eight. But just to go back on these ones, you see the big thing which I have done here, which differs from what you've had before, is instead of right effort, right endeavour, it's restraining. I'd even like to call it right stopping or right non-doing, but that's very hard. The endeavour of restraint, the endeavour abandoned, the endeavour to develop, the endeavour to maintain, it's all based on a letting go, a stopping, a non-doing. Because if you try to do these things, you'll find you just get more tense and you won't get anywhere. And I'll just go now with this one last little thing which I was mentioning in England a few days ago, that Professor Libet did some marvellous research to show that there's no such thing as what you consider to be free will. He did a sort of experiment which he had so many victims or subjects, whatever you wish to call them, and they would flex their hands whenever they wanted to. When they decided to flex their hand, they would press a button. And he also, he could actually reflex time from pressing the button to flexing your hand, so he could actually see when the person became aware that they decided they chose to flex their wrist to the millisecond, at the same time had a gizmo on the brain which was recording the readiness potential. Parts of the brain light up, and what he found, which was very confronting, was the brain lights up first, then the thing which you recognize as will comes next, and then the action follows afterwards. So that which you recognize, assume to be will, is not what starts the process. It's not the origin of the event. By the time that you think you will something, it's already in motion. The will does not start. Something else has made you will. But, he said, after the process is stopped, is started, you can interfere and stop it. He said, that can be done. So, in a very wonderful use of the English language, he wrote, now with good proof, there's no such thing as free will, but there is free won't. Restraining, stopping. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm not going to say that. No, I'm not going to act in that way. It is conditioning. What creates the brain's lighting up? It's called conditioning, brainwashing. Brainwashing by hypnosis, brainwashing by advertising, brainwashing by peer pressure. A trigger happens and automatically something comes up and then you will. You think it's your choice. The best example which I ever saw was really, I can never forget this because it really shook me. When I was a student, we'd have Psychic Research Society. Every year we get really cool people coming up. One of them was a witch. Every year a witch would come out. I still remember his name, Trevor Ravenscroft. He must be dead by now. What a great name for a witch, Trevor Ravenscroft. And he would come up, and I remember his lecture. You know, it was a bit, for the first time I'd seen a witch. And he said there are two types of witches in the world, white witches and black witches. Black witches, they're the dangerous ones. Don't even go near those. Those are, you know, really got to be, they're scary. He said, don't worry, I'm a white witch, so you're safe. And then he would say, but you know, even black witches say they're white. And he let us pause and laugh. So he was a bit of an entertainer. He'd obviously done that quite a few times. But then he hypnotized, no, another one was a hypnotist. And the hypnotist, you know, asked many people to be hypnotized. It is in the old days. Hypnotism has got much better since then. More people can be hypnotized. In those days, only a few. But there's always one student. In about 100 people in the audience, there's always one who get totally hypnotized and made these stupid things. But the most important part was when the hypnotist said, later on, when I touch my right earlobe, you'll stand up and sing the British National Anthem in full in a loud voice. What a ridiculous thing to do. And of course, you took him out of hypnosis, sat down in his seat, did a few other little demonstrations. Then he touched his right earlobe. And this student, in the middle of howling, well, I was laughing, I was wetting my pants almost, because it was so funny. And this fellow, he didn't stop, he sang the whole British National Anthem from beginning to end, in a loud voice. What a ridiculous thing to do. But then, when we stopped laughing, he asked him, why do you do that when all these people are laughing at you? And he gave a good reason for it, a logical reason. And that was scary, because it was clear to all of us. For him, even as the most ridiculous thing he'd done, it was his, just the same, he could not distinguish that from a freely chosen action. It appeared the same to him, although we all knew he was made to do that by hypnotic suggestion. But he could not distinguish what he was made to do through hypnosis, conditioning, to what he assumed to be free will. So how much of your free will is actually yours? How much have you been conditioned? But what you can do is free will. interfere, say, no, I'm not going to do that.
So then let's, as a hypothetical, look at the fact that maybe someone who hasn't been conditioned by society has lived, I don't know, whatever, and their mind is basically clean. How would that affect?
Well, actually, that thing cannot exist because we're all conditioned by our different societies. But what it does show you, when you're in a totally different society, indigenous societies, without TV, without the sort of, you know, you're conditioned by your own peer pressure there. Different conditioning, but literally different ways of looking at the world. So that's interesting. But I better move on now because that's the right endeavour. So it's all about stopping. The free won't. The no. The stop. Restraint. Letting go. So that's why I call it endeavour. Effort is doing. This one of the Eightfold Paths is a not doing. A stopping. Restraint. Say no to stuff. And anyway, we get onto the first part of right mindfulness, which is a big one. Obviously, there's no way we can finish it this today, but we'll just get the introduction to it. What now is right mindfulness? First of all, that translation is absolutely brilliant. It was Professor Rhys Davids did this over 100 years ago. You know, he did also concentration for the eighth factor, which was a big mistake, but this one was absolutely brilliant. This is where mindfulness came from. He invented, coined the word. The four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crime, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana, what for? Now there are, and I don't mind saying this, mischievous monks who say the four focuses of mindfulness are the only path to the purification of beings. There's no way for anyone who knows Pali, anyone who's read the suttas, even the commentaries, it never means that way. That is a really mischievous interpretation. It's not just mindfulness. You need all the other factors of the Eightfold Path as well. And lead in one direction only, that was Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, which is, you can't really get better than that, I think, in this context. Lead in one direction only, to enlightenment. So what are these four focuses of mindfulness? Having restrained the five hindrances, now you can see how this is following on from what went before. The right endeavour is restraining these things. Restrain them first of all, and then we can actually practice the next factor, the mindfulness. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of experience. This is the what I call a Vedana. There's a few little translations, new ones, which I'll explain afterwards. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you're aware of the mind, the jitta. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of mind objects. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. First of all, having restrained the five hindrances, in the Pali it's Lokeya Bija. Vinaya Lokeya Bija Dhammanasang. The usual translation is having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world, which even when I was a lay Buddhist, what the heck does that mean, grief and covetousness for the world? And if you actually look in the Pali, it's the synonyms for the first two of the five hindrances. Lokeya Bija is used as an alternative for Kamachanda, the first of the five hindrances. And Dhammanasa is used in two suttas as an alternative for the second hindrance. And if you look for the commentaries to both Satipatthana suttas, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya and the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, both of those, the commentaries say, these words mean having abandoned Kapna, Lokeya Bija Dhammanasang, Vinaya, so that means having abandoned the first two hindrances. The commentators are consistent, and there is ground for that interpretation, very solid, convincing ground from the suttas. So that's what we have to do, restraining the five hindrances. And they also say, this is the idioms of Pali, if you have the first two of a group, all the others in the group are assumed to be present as well. It's just, you know, when you say, we might say the BSW way and its monasteries, that's not very good. You have like the, I don't know even who is in the Australian cricket team anymore, but you have the captain, the vice captain, etc. The etc. is always included as the other people who play on the cricket team. So here, when you have five things and the first two are mentioned, the commentaries always say the other things are also included. So this is an accurate description, restraining the five hindrances. I haven't abandoned the five hindrances yet. You've restrained them, lessened them, especially by what you've done so far. The previous factor, right effort. Previous to that was, not right effort, sorry, right endeavour. Previous to that was your precepts, which help also restrain the hindrances just by right speech, right action, right livelihood. Before that, the right motivation. Motivations, you heard me say this before, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That actually restrains hindrances, and obviously coming from right view. So these all link together here. Restrain the five hindrances first, otherwise you're not mindful. You abide aware of four things: the body, experience. Sometimes it's called feelings. Feelings is not a very good word. It can be emotional, it can be body sensations, but what it really means is this thing which we notice as experience. The Buddha defines experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or in between. But that is just the way of pointing to sort of what we're actually looking at, the experience. Just as well, you might say heat, cold, windy. That points to weather. You know, there's sort of the climate. So it's not really feelings, not pleasure, pain in between. It's pointing out this thing which we know is experience. And the mind, the jitta, this is when the five senses disappear, you know what that is. And the mind objects, you'll find later on, this was really good work by people like Ajahn Sujato and Alio and Ajahn Bhamali, who actually looked at versions of the Satipatthana and discovered that the earliest versions, the mind object only had two mind objects to focus on. And that was the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors, just those two. It seems the other ones were added later on. It's not wrong to add those, but it takes away the focus of these are being aware of the hindrances which actually block you from developing the path and becoming enlightened, or focusing on the opposite, that which actually develops enlightenment. And that was actually a very powerful understanding of why those two were there. Other ones added later, they're not wrong, but they take the focus away from the meaning of why the Buddha actually chose those things as part of the Satipatthana. Energized, so you can't do this sloth and torpor. You do this when you've developed some restraint, develop the restraint of the hindrances. As I was saying, and the question you said afterwards, you get energized when you have restraint. Knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. So knowing the purpose of what you are doing, so often I've told people, yeah, mindfulness is great as long as you remember the purpose of what you are doing. So, if you're driving a car in the busy traffic, you are not focusing on your breath. Breathing in, breathing, you get a crash. You focus on the traffic. But what's the purpose of driving? Or when you are late for an aircraft, then you don't do slow walking, lifting, lifting. You run. So sometimes it's absolutely crazy that when you don't follow the Satipatthana, what's the purpose of what you're doing? And of course the other one, which you've heard me say many times, is people say, oh, Buddhists should always let go, let go, let go, let go. Except if on the back of a motorbike through heavy traffic. Attach. Do not let go. Otherwise you'll fall off and injure yourself. So why are you doing this? Why are you watching the body? Why are you watching the experience? Why are you aware of the mind? Why are you aware of the mind objects? Why? And that will become very clear in a few moments. And mindful. Let's see. in brief, the Satipatthana. So, how are you mindful of the body? And there's many objects of body awareness. There's breathing, there's the four postures, comprehension of the purpose, bodily parts, elements, the chana ground, meditations. But anyway, we'll start with just the breath. You go to a quiet, secluded place, sit down comfortably, and give priority to establishing mindfulness. That's this standard anapanasati. Quiet, secluded place, if you can. There are secluded places around. It's amazing that even in cities, some of the quietest places can be in apartment buildings, where just you don't hear stuff. Here I heard something a few moments ago, I think it was the ice cream van. You don't hear the ice cream van when you're in the 26th story of an apartment block. So sometimes you wonder, like hermits living in the city. You know, you can actually disappear in a city, because in a forest you get all these people just coming to see you, and fire officers and other people making sure you're safe for the fire season. So sometimes I wonder whether we should be forest monks in a city. Secluded. Peaceful. Anyway, I always have these ideas. Just always think outside the box. So you go to a secluded place, sit down comfortably. Now that was a translation. Just so you don't have to sit down in full lotus with your back straight but pain all over the place. Sit down comfortably and give priority to establishing mindfulness. A word is paramukha, which means, some people say, in front of you. And that word, in front of you, in front of what? Where am I? It doesn't say in front of the nose, it doesn't say in front of the belly, it's paramukha. And it does not mean literally, physically, spatially in front. It means like the same word as giving it priority. Giving it first place, in front, the first thing you need to do. So that's why I give priority to establishing mindfulness. That's actually what we do. So before you can watch the breath, you establish mindfulness first of all. And it's from that where you get me, monks like me, teaching, sit down and just relax the body, be mindful of the body, before the body's nice and comfortable, and then present moment awareness. Just subdue your thinking, just so that you can be in this moment. If you're still thinking of the past and future, or thinking about anything, you're not really being mindful. So when you're silent in this moment, you've established mindfulness. You know, that's one of the reasons why people do breath meditation, they think they can't do it. Or they do it for just a short period of time, then it runs away. Because they haven't done the preparation, they haven't made the foundation. Do the foundation first, and then it's so easy afterwards. So anyway, that is just giving the beginning of the mindfulness, which will come the next time I'm sitting here. But today, we just focused on the right endeavor. Any questions from here before we get the ones from overseas? Yes?
I've heard it say that hindrances can't be restrained unless one develops the Eightfold Path. Is that correct?
No, what it actually says is the Nalakarpana Sutta, 68, I think, if I got that number right, is that without having experienced the jhanas, the five hindrances invade the mind and remain together with weariness and discontent. So that's a saying of the Buddha in Nalakarpana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya. So what we're saying here, that to really get those five hindrances abandoned, you do the jhanas. And then they're gone for hours, or even days sometimes. And no discontent, just happy no matter what happens, and no weariness, you're full of energy. So often you can't sleep at night, which is fine, you don't need to. So, but to restrain the hindrances, is different than overcoming them. And restraining the hindrances is done by the other ways of the path. There are things like stopping, letting go. For example, you know, of lust or something. You know, if you start a fantasy, if you start it and you don't stop it quickly, it's got you. You start, you know, anger, a train of thought. It's a very beautiful English metaphor, a train of thought. If you can stop the train when it's just leaving the station, it stops pretty quickly, within a few feet. But if it's running along the tracks at 120 kilometers an hour, it's very hard to stop. It takes, you know, a long time. So that is why it's just the restraining of the hindrances. It's enough to be mindful to actually to go deeper and to stop them for hours. Okay, let's get some from overseas. Here we go. Oops. From, oh, someone living in Thailand. Part one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, right now I'm confused with terminology, especially as some come from other schools too. These might cover each other completely or partially. My question at the moment is, would you please clarify the difference of similarities between mindfulness, consciousness, awakening, and awareness? Okay, the mindfulness and awareness are pretty much identical. So to be aware is like being mindful. But also that sometimes the mindfulness means something a little bit more than being unaware. It's always usually accompanied by knowing what you should be doing with this. It's mindfulness and wisdom, or sati sampajana or sati panya. And the example of that is a story of a very wealthy woman, because you're staying from Thailand here, in Thailand, who goes to the temple one evening, and she tells the guard of her mansion, a little gatehouse in the front, please be mindful this evening, there's many burglars around, and many houses in the district have been robbed. And so the guard said, yes, madam, I will be mindful. And when she comes back from the temple, she finds that her mansion has been ransacked. The robbers have been in there and taken everything. So she's very upset at her gatekeeper, her guard, her security. I told you security guards to be mindful. But we were, madam. Well, how come we got robbed? Well, madam, I was very mindful, very aware. Burglars were going into the house, and I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. And I saw them coming out of your mansion carrying all your jewelry, and I was noting jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them go back in again with their big truck, their lorry, and I noted lorry going in, lorry, and I saw them, the safe, the big safe. I saw the safe being put onto the truck and going out. Safe going out, safe going out. I was mindful all the time, madam. I was totally aware. That's why that's mindfulness without wisdom. Awareness without knowing the consequences of what you're doing. So in Dharma, it's not just being mindful, it's actually being aware as well. And the consciousness, being conscious, is everyone is conscious unless they're dead. But the connection between mindfulness and consciousness is mindfulness is usually focused on really important areas of life. Now things like, you know, you're aware of the body. Yeah, you're conscious of the body, but you're aware in it in the sense that certain practices which can underline or uncover the nature of this body, the nature of experience, the mind. So that's why these four focuses of mindfulness are like the four little like mines as they have in Western Australia. Wells where you can find really sweet water. Places where you can find treasure. So places to look, which are really important. So mindfulness focus on places where you really find something. And awakening, that actually has a very good connection with mindfulness and awareness. As mindfulness becomes empowered, in other words, you're really mindful, as I was saying earlier, because of stillness, developing mindfulness becomes more and more energized. As it becomes more and more energized, you see more, what you see becomes more enjoyable, beautiful, so hard to get negative. Your awareness gets empowered. And it is like you're awakening. You may think you're fully awake now, ha ha ha. Compared to when you get into really deep meditation and come out afterwards, wow, now I really am awake. You can see so much more, you can feel. Just there's a small breeze coming in through the doors this afternoon here, and it's just, you can really feel it fully. You're really awake to it. Now, multiply that and multiply that, that's like being really awake. And that's actually the meaning of the word Buddha. It comes from the Pali word Bhujati, which means to wake up. It's not wake up to some idea and just, come on stupid, wake up. It's actually naturally being able to see, being able to know, being able to feel so fully. That's awakening, that's what awakening is. Anyway, hopefully that's helpful for you in Thailand. And from the USA, non-self at times has caused me to do too little, believing there's no free will anyway, so why even try? How to avoid this danger? You are willing yourself to be lazy. So, it's not free will, it's free won't, so I won't be lazy. I will do whatever is necessary because you are being conditioned not from your own ideas, not from lazy ideas, but from the idea also of compassion, kindness, which leads to service. You can take the message from someone like a Buddha, someone who is, you know, so compassionate, you just work your butt off for other people. This is when I've ever gone to see Ajahn Gunha, which many of you know him, great monk. That he was the monk, then the last time I told you this story, here we go. That the rumor was going around the monks that he was fully enlightened. So that was the rumor, another gossip going around. And so he was there under Ajahn Chah's hut with all the senior monks. You know, as many, many more senior than him. And so Ajahn Chah started a conversation. And he asked the most senior monk there, I think it was Ajahn Jan at the time, Ajahn Jan, are you enlightened yet? He said, no. And asked the next monk, how about you? No. All the monks, are you? No. And he got to Ajahn Gunha, he said, yes. And that meant everyone, wow, in front of the great teacher. He'd said he's got no more defilements. What would happen next? Well, Ajahn Chah said, come upstairs. And you'd always wished you were the fly on the wall. What did Ajahn Chah say? What did he do to this monk? And so, you know, we didn't know at the time, but we found out afterwards. And he said, your job is to develop lots of loving kindness, metta, compassion. Develop that. So that's why he became, many of you got to see him, became just a compassionate, kind monk. That drives you. So, believing there is no free will, you don't believe it. It's nothing about belief, it's realization, knowing it. And if it really is, sort of letting go of the sense of self, then it's the sense of others. Me, them, all the same. Connection between the two of us. And then, what replaces desire and craving is kindness and service. So, the sign that you've understood non-self is not you become lazy, but you work even harder than before. Compassion drives you. Not what I want, but what is needed for service. So hopefully that makes sense. Anyway, any comments or questions about that? Going. Okay, very good. So, we usually now pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and thank you again for those questions from overseas and the questions here. Okay, you can do the sadhus. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.